The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. And we get to all of those emails and comments later on in the podcast where we savour them, we ponder them, we ruminate, we toss them around in our mouth and really get a good feel of them, and then we spit them out. Kind of went a bit farther, didn't I? Coming up on this week's programme, can you sense the Earth's magnetic field? A controversial new study at a Caltech claims yes. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's news stories. And joining me are physicist and assistant professor in science education at UCD, Shane Bergen, and Dr. Laura Duncan. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Hello. Oh, it's a boy. And what a boy!
That's the umbilical cord. It's a girl.
Our first story has to do with gender selection and IVF, Laura.
It does indeed. And like a lot of the lovely stories that we do during the summer, this is a terrible story, but I'm actually really glad that we're talking about it because I like sometimes to talk about bad science. Not that the science is bad, but I like to kind of spew vitriol rather than extol the virtues of wonderful scientists. And this is a story that comes from Japan where they're basically saying they took mice sperm. And for anyone who doesn't know, a sperm only has one X or one Y chromosome. So they have half of the same amount of chromosomes that we would have in a normal cell, not in an egg or a sperm. And whether you get a Y or an X depends on whether it's a boy or a girl. So all the eggs have X and the sperm have one or the other. And there's a lot of like kind of old wives' tales that go around, like the Y chromosome is smaller. That's not an old wives' tale. That's real. But people say that that's why more baby boys are born, because it's lighter and it gets to the egg faster. That's not true. But more baby boys are born. There's 105 baby boys to every 100 baby girls. But this story is basically saying how we can gender select. Go for it. You look like you have a question.
I do. Does that not...
You boy, you look like you have something to say.
But doesn't that even out?
It does over life. And actually,
when you're 20 years old...
There's more adult women. Yeah, because actually men die more frequently at every single stage of life.
Because
you're
stupid.
Weaker. Stupid too, but it is also weaker. So, yep, go me. So basically what they've done is they've taken mouse sperm and they've
How
put...
How do they collect that?
Oh, I actually don't know and I don't want to know. I would imagine with a needle into testicles, I would suspect, I would hope. And they have put on an anti-cancer drug. It's also an anti-cancer and antiviral drug. And what happens is only the sperm that have an X chromosome express a lot more proteins. So for instance, TLR7 or 8. And the anti-cancer drug binds to these and it sort of immobilizes them temporarily. And so then all the ones with the Y are able to keep on swimming. So they just sort of scoop them off the top. And then they mix them with the eggs and they make kind of a load of male babies. And then they take the remaining ones and they mix them with eggs and make a load of female babies.
Oh.
And I suppose it's grand in theory. But I just would love to know the practicality of this. There's potential practicalities in the beef and dairy industry because you want female dairy cows and you want male beef cows. So maybe that's practical. But I mean, who's going to take their sperm, subject it to an anti-cancer drug that basically paralyzes it on the off chance that it does nothing long term, and then use that to pick the gender of your baby? Who's so important, or who is it that it's so important to have the gender picked that you would be willing to put an anti-cancer drug on your baby?
Sadly, it is, as we learned on this program, it is a large swathe of the global population.
It's against the law in the UK to pick based on gender. You can in the US, but you can't here. We're not in the UK.
Oh. Ouch.
China, the Caucasus, India, selection rates for
females. That's some of the reasons why it's actually 107 boys to 100 girls, not actually 105 if you take China and India into account, but you have to disregard them because of the horrendous, you know, genocide of
so you can see
small
why,
baby girls.
But you're absolutely right. In agriculture, there might be a benefit to this. But
sure.
The technique could work in humans?
But we already have the technique. In IVF, you can pick if you want to. You're in a country where it's legal. You can pick the gender of your baby if you so wish. You can pick to make sure your baby doesn't have cystic fibrosis or some other inheritable disease, which is the reason this technology exists, and it's wonderful. But if you're that so inclined, you can pick the gender of your baby. Just go to America to do it.
It is worrying, though, the number of things you can now select. Like I listened to a great podcast from Radiolab called G about intelligence, and it's saying now that in California there's research going on that you can select based on the predicted IQ of the child. The IQ itself is a really poor measurement of intelligence, and then you're
and also
picking
happiness.
Yeah, yes, ridiculous. Absolutely. So absolutely ridiculous.
These sorts of things come
I'm
all the time.
I'm depressed a lot of the time, and that's probably because of my IQ.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You are too smart for your own good. No, I mean, look, I think people need to stop tinkering with babies unless it's very specifically to help combat inherited disease.
Our second story has to do with lightning.
Yes, very, very frightening. sorry.
The first time I've ever laughed at a Shane Bergen.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's very unusual to have lightning on or near the North Pole. When I thought of this, I thought of lightning actually hitting a metal pole, which isn't there, right?
So, is there not? Did they not put up like
a flag?
Red and white
stripy
pole?
There is a flag, but there isn't one on the North Pole because like the sea ice moves. There's only one on the South Pole. So anyway, it's very unusual to have lightning up there because you don't get the right atmospheric conditions, which is a layer of cold air on top with warm, moist air below it. And you get this turbulence between the two layers. This causes friction. That friction builds static and you get discharge of an electric nature, different to Lara's story. And so normally warm air that would move, say, from Siberia out into the Arctic Ocean, it will move across large bits of sheets of ice and that will cool it. And so you don't get any rumbling. But this, just last weekend, an incredible 48 strikes of lightning were detected using a very cool system. And this has raised the eyebrows of a number of meteorologists around the world because, as I said, it's very unusual for lightning to happen there. It is indicative, unfortunately, yet again, of the effects of climate change.
It's actually surprising there's any room left on the forehead for these eyebrows to I can't stop
picturing the eyebrows raised. It was so evocative.
of these meteorologists are going, well, this is unusual. Like literally just looking out the window going,
their eyebrows have merged with their hairline.
It's weird to see flying fire. That's a new one on me.
Most meteorologists are physicists, and so eyebrow raising amongst that community is not normal. So so because there has been an incredibly warm summer in the Arctic this year, a lot of the sea ice has melted, and so this is facilitating more of the conditions for lightning to strike. It is cool how they measure this. So they have an array of detectors that are around the world, the radio receivers, and they're all linked using GPS, and so this network of detectors is able to pinpoint where lightning strikes anywhere around the planet at any time.
Wow.
At the moment, there are around 2,000 thunderstorms happening around the world. I can't say where, but on average, there's about 2,000.
Just
happening.
Give me the top 50.
I know, he's like, I can't say, are you bound by secrecy laws?
Physics rules.
Physics
I'd tell
rules.
You, but I'd have to kill
it's
you.
A secret handshake.
That's amazing. So we know if there's a lightning strike happening anywhere in the world, it's recorded somewhere. That's pretty cool. Okay, our third story, Lara, has to do with an anxiety molecule.
Yeah, this is a cool story. And it's a really good example of how hard work and graft and basic science can come up with good results. So it came from the University of California. And what they did was they looked at the amygdala, which is a small part of the brain, obviously in humans, but also in primates. This is where they looked at rhesus macaques. And it controls not only the fear response, but also anxiety. And anxiety is a huge issue in humans. Massive, massive problem. Depression and anxiety are going to be two of the most expensive diseases to treat by 2030. And it's a massive issue that we need to target. And what they did was, over 8 years, they looked at all the proteins that were produced in the amygdala. And they basically, one by one, went through all of them. And they found one called neurotrophin 3, which helps. Yeah, obviously one of my old faves. Shane's looking like he's fully in on neurotrophin 3 there. It's one of, neuro is neuron and trophin is to grow. So it's one of the chemicals that helps your neurons to grow. And what they did was they upregulated it. They put a kind of a virus in that upregulated in the amygdala. They had far lower levels of anxiety-related symptoms. And the other thing I love, so they did an MRI as well to see if it kind of functionally works, and it did. But the other thing I loved is that they had a set of candidate proteins, but they can't do all the work themselves. And they've published this at the end of their paper. They say, look, here's 10, 20, I don't know how many other proteins that we think are good targets. If anyone wants to look and help us out, then do. And I just think that's the exact spirit of sort of scientific endeavour.
I have a stupid question. Oh. Is anxiety not a good thing? Does it not tell you to stop doing things that are harmful for you?
So obviously some levels of anxiety are completely normal and we all experience anxiety, but it's general anxiety disorder or harmful anxiety that's the problem that we need to try and dampen down. But yeah, we don't want these people who are, you know, I don't know, like sailing off the side of mountains. Can you sail off a mountain? Doing silly things, risk-taking behavior we don't want. But obviously anxiety is such a huge issue for those who suffer from it.
I have a four-year-old and an eight-year-old, and the eight-year-old would just run across the road. Zero anxiety. Jeez. And the four-year-old would just, you know, cling on to my leg. So you want something in the middle.
And what was Casper like that when he was four? Was he risk-taking or was he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
So he has been the whole time. It's fascinating. Yeah. It's just fascinating.
My children are fascinating. Final story, robotic shorts. These are shorts you're wearing now. Are they
shorts? Yes.
Are you testing the prototype?
I am. These are the ultimate big boy pants. So, So scientists at Harvard, actually an Irish scientist called Conor Walsh, he did his degree in Trinity, have done some amazing work with, I suppose it's like Elon Musk-esque physics or engineering. And they have built this device that allows you to do more with less. So it's an exosuit. So you put it on, it looks like cycling pants or cycling trousers, which have never really looked good at any period, right? But,
no.
You know, maybe if you can walk using 9% less energy or run using 4% less energy, as these shorts will allow you to do, you might want to buy them. Or if you are somebody who suffers with multiple sclerosis, you have Parkinson's disease, or you're a stroke survivor and you find it difficult to move, this sort of technology might be something you're interested in.
Yeah, and it's impressive because we've evolved over, you know, millennia to have a, you know, a really well adapted body. The idea that you can use something non-electrical to improve the engineering that has gone through such natural selection is pretty impressive, right?
So it is, but there is some sort of an electrical thing in there, right? In that you have a belt around your waist and then you have these two things around your thighs. And so you're basically actuating. So you're applying an electrical voltage and that causes something to move. And so basically the trousers are helping your hip joint extend further and move better.
Yeah, so, but it's a mechanical thing.
It is mechanical, yeah. But it has to be driven by something. So you need a power source, right, for that. So, but this is a prototype, and when you look at it, you can go, it's ingenious in how simple it is. Like, but then when you think about how the engineers went about building it and the materials that will go into the next generation device, it's actually pretty cool. Like, so they're blending material science with artificial intelligence to build something like this, so that it can work for me, or I give them to you, and then it'll work for you, or it'll work for Lara.
Do they come in pinstripe like yours?
So the early stages.
Candy stripe, I think, is the probably.
You have
the
to wear them with
term.
The red Converse though, or else it doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. So if they come like that, maybe I'll buy them. of course, the funding for this, a little worryingly, like in the States, a lot of the research funding is for the army. And so, you know, you can imagine somebody who has a heavy backpack being able to go further. But I think what's very interesting is the applications for those who are suffering with or have had a medical condition where they need help with their mobility.
Indeed. Well, Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Dungan, thank you very much for joining. Now, a recent study seems to show that like many animals and birds, human beings can sense the magnetic field of the Earth. As they say on the internet, huge if true. Joe Kirschvink is the Van Wingen Professor of Geobiology at Caltech. He led the research. He joins me now. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Jonathan.
You're very welcome to the program, Joe. Maybe you might start off by telling me how we have a magnetic field at all.
Well, that's an interesting thing. The Earth is basically a big bar magnet, but not quite a bar magnet. The magnetic field is generated by the outer core of the Earth. It's a big blob of molten nickel iron. Conductive, but extremely high temperatures, it rotates, and as it rotates, electric currents flow in it, and those electric currents are what generate the magnetic field.
How fast does this wet ball of nickel at the center of the Earth spin?
Oh, it's one revolution per day.
But hang on, wait, if it's spinning and we're spinning, then how does it create?
Yeah, there's convective forces in it. There's a little bit of extra velocity, about one extra turn every 3,000 years.
So how strong is the magnetic field compared to a fridge magnet, for example?
If you ask a physicist about the Earth's magnetic field, he'll say, oh, it's very weak in the room that we're in. And that's because physicists like to study things like neutron stars or black holes where the magnetic fields are really, really intense. Compared to a refrigerator magnet, a typical refrigerator magnet would be a couple hundred times stronger than the background magnetic field that we're in. Really good refrigerator magnets, these rare earth magnets, the ones you use to lift refrigerators, you know, those are about 1,000 times stronger.
Are they the sort of things that we see in MRIs?
Oh, yeah. MRIs have been stronger than that. They use superconducting circuits to make a really intense magnetic field. So you're talking 10,000 times stronger than the background field in a typical MRI.
So we know that animals can detect the magnetic field. There are different ways of doing this, right?
Well, there are three major theories that have been proposed to explain how an animal might detect the magnetic field. The simplest and easiest, and actually the one with the most direct data, is to use a little bar magnet. We have magnetic bacteria that are common in almost any environment, every mud puddle you see out there. If you look carefully at the top layer of the mud, you can find these little bacteria that'll swim to the pole of a magnet. You can look at it under a microscope, you can see millions of bacteria swimming, flip the magnet, and they swim the other way. And when you look at those cells with high-resolution microscopy, you see little chains of the mineral magnetite. So that's the easiest one. If you ask a physicist, well, how could an animal detect a magnetic field? Well, they'd say, well, you flap the wing and maybe you induce electric currents and somehow you measure the electricity. That one actually works maybe in sharks, when it's sharks and rays, when they're in seawater with a good conductive medium around it. The third mechanism is kind of a weird quantum mechanical effect where the eye would intercept some photons and split a chemical bond and make electrically charged free radicals, they're called. And under some circumstances, those might have a magnetic effect. But actually, the model that has the most evidence is the simple one.
How do we see animals using magnetic field in their lives?
This is one of the surprising and most controversial things over the last 40, 50 years. It's clear that if you're a migrating animal, you really need to get to your feeding ground, to the breeding ground, back and forth, etc. Food tends to be more abundant at high latitudes in the summer. And so that's why animals like to migrate towards the poles and back. But if you make a mistake and don't get there, you die. So natural selection for navigation is very, very strong. And the ecology of why animals would migrate is really fundamental to animal behavior. And so it's not surprising that navigation ability is really prevalent. Homing, for example, our not so distant human ancestors were hunter-gatherers. You would go out and grab rabbits and whatever you could find, bushes. You need to get back to where your family is. Otherwise, the kids die, right? So homing and navigation is fundamental. And the magnetic field turns out to be a very good, very reliable, usually, means of orientation. I mean, if it's overcast at night, you can't see the stars, and you have a magnetic compass, you're much better off than if you don't.
Mm. But have we proven that animals use magnetic fields to migrate and find their way through navigation? Have there been tests to do that? How would you even design a study like that?
There are hundreds of experiments in that. You can use natural observations. For example, if you just look at the distribution of whales on the high seas, and people have been doing airplane surveys of whale migrations for years. But if you take the position of where those groups of whales are and look at it relative to the magnetic anomalies in the ocean, what you find, what we found, is that they follow the magnetic lineations.
Right.
The places they are controlled by the marine magnetic stripes, which are north-south, beautiful migratory paths if you follow those. Similarly, if you capture some European robins that are trying to migrate from Siberia down to North Africa, wherever, and put them in an isolated cage in some basement under very controlled conditions, they have a restless migration. They want to migrate in the right direction, and they will hop. And that hopping behavior is controllable by the magnetic field.
No.
I mean, if I turn the magnetic field 90 degrees, the birds will change their hop direction.
No.
Yes.
Wow, that is cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. But, you know, if you give them another means of orientation, sunlight, polarization, some other directional cue, they'll follow that.
I
so
see.
You need to get rid of all these other ones. But if you deprive them of everything except magnetism, they use the magnetism. And what that means, there has to be a specialized cell somewhere in their body that detects the magnetic field. Mm. And that magnetic information is sent back to the brain. The brain interprets it and says, okay, yeah, this is the direction to go in.
So we've seen this in bees, for bees to get out of beehives, in rodents as well. They've seen, is that right, that yes. rodents can detect magnetic fields?
The beautiful example, Zambian mole rats. They're subterranean. They never really come above ground. And yet they build tunnels that are kilometers long, dead arrow straight along magnetic compass directions. And if you take them into a laboratory and do this thing, you change the magnetic field, you can make the tunnels go in any direction you want.
My God. So yeah. How does this work? I mean, with birds, I think I read something about some magnetic material in their nose or their beak. What's the physics of how these animals use that magnetic field to migrate?
The important thing is that this mineral magnetite is a permanent magnet. It's an Fe304, it's an iron oxide, inverse spinel, I could go on and on. But all of the little iron atoms have electrons that are unpaired in a quantum mechanical sense, and they line up their tiny magnetic moments all together. It's a property of the crystal. And so I can have a nanocrystal of magnetite that's really tiny, 50 nanometers across. And yet, in the Earth's magnetic field, it overcomes Brownian motion, and it passively aligns. And then if I put a string of those together, that whole thing is a bar magnet that just wants to point north. What we think is going on is that there are specialized cells, neural receptors, that have little channels in the membrane that can be opened or closed by the motion of these magnets. And when you open and close an ion channel, you change the voltage across the sensory membrane, and that controls the rate that this cell fires. And the brain can look at that signal and say, okay, I'm pointing north now because all the ion channels are closed, or, oh my God, it's south because they're all open.
Yeah.
And then you do this from hundreds and thousands and millions of these crystals, and the brain can integrate that and say, okay, this is the direction and intensity of the magnetic field.
And of course, that information wouldn't necessarily mean something to the brain, but over time, through natural selection, through sort of trial and effort, birds, bees, rodents have figured out that if I sense this, this means something, and it can I can use it. And which is actually one of the great things about evolution, is our ability to take noise and make shape and put meaning in it.
Oh, totally, totally. Every sensory modality is produced by natural selection on behavior. And if you think about the history of these magnetic crystals, they are in every major group of the bacterial domain. And in fact, we published a paper a couple of years ago showing that this magnetic ability predates the major burst of radiation of the bacteria. That puts it over 3 billion years old. So it's really ancient. It's probably the primal sense. And it's in everything, even protozoa. Single-celled protists exist that have the same magnetite crystals. The animals that have it clearly had it before the Cambrian explosion. So migration and animal navigation using magnetic field goes back easily 500 million years.
So let's talk about your most recent study, because this is the one that really caught our eye, where it was claimed in your study that humans can sense the Earth's magnetic field. So can you talk to us a little bit about what you did and how you tested our ability to sense the magnetic field? And then we might talk about why this is seen by some as controversial.
Oh, sure. So imagine a chamber in the sub-basement of an science building. And we want to get a very clean environment. So we construct a 2 by 2 by 2 meter cube of aluminum with a folding door panel, inside of which we build a very precise coil system that can be used to change the magnetic field silently and quietly with coils that are designed to do internal controls, et cetera, et cetera. We put a non-magnetic chair in there. We seat the subject in this very comfortable wooden chair in the dark facing north, and we put 64 electrodes on the skull, on the head, recording the brain activity, particularly the alpha wave band is what was interesting. And we asked the subject just to sit there quietly, thinking about clouds or some memories, trying not to go to sleep. And while they're doing this, we silently move the magnetic field a little bit. It's kind of like turning your head left to right, right to left, or nodding up and down. And it turns out, if you have a subject like that in this environment, very quiet, the 10 hertz signal in the brain, which is called the alpha wave, usually gets very strong, and the brain is quiet, and it kind of hums at 10 hertz if it's peaceful. But if you were to go and give a sound or a little tap on the foot or a shock or something, the brain kind of, oh my God, something's happened. Different parts of the brain drop out of this hum, and the alpha waves go away while the brain tries to figure out what's going on. And a few seconds later, it recovers when it realizes there's no danger. So this is a very powerful measure that the brain has detected something, and it's not always conscious. So what we did and what we found is that if you rotate the magnetic field in kind of a natural environment, simulating just turning your head, the brain waves collapse for the next few seconds.
So the controversy about this is that, and this is to quote Thorsten Ritz, a biophysicist at UC Irvine, saying, if I stuck my head in a microwave and switched it on, I'd see effects on my alpha waves. It doesn't necessarily mean my brain can sense them. How do you separate just physical changes that would happen naturally from an idea that there is a sense, so to speak?
With all due respect to Thurston Ritz, that's bullshit. Sticking your head in a microwave is totally different. That induces electric currents that heat the tissue to the point where the function stops. This is not what happens when you turn your head silently left or right.
So you're saying it's not the waves affecting the physical tissue.
No.
It's our brain responding to the change in magnetic field.
Precisely. And you can actually demonstrate it. The way we set the experiment up, we can actually flip a set of switches, and the computer doesn't know it, nobody else knows it, and instead of the magnetic field changing, what we've done is we actually flip the current in one of the pairs of wires in each coil. So the current's the same, the dynamics are the same, the vibrations are the same, except there's no magnetic field generated.
So why do people not like this idea?
There's no response.
I mean, this seems like very convincing to me, but why have people come out and said, oh, this isn't right, or we're going to have to see more results? Like, why do scientists come out and do that?
Well, sure, because they're not consciously aware of it. The editor of one of the prime journals we submitted it to, you know, the journal had it in review for several months, and the reviews came through, we responded to them. But then the biomedical editor of that journal said, I don't believe it. I just don't believe it. I don't perceive the magnetic field, therefore it can't be right, which is total BS.
This sounds amazing, Joe. And if it's, you know, proven to be replicated, you have found a fundamental sense that we didn't really know about humans. It's a huge discovery. My question is, what does knowing this do for science and for us? Is there any way we can use this, or how does it help us at all in terms of understanding the human mind?
Well, Jonathan, humans have been using electromagnetism as a part of their technology for the last 100 years. We've done so without realizing that humans have a magnetic sense. For example, the headsets that aviation pilots use wipe out the magnetic field, 10 times stronger magnetic field through the head than natural. And yet, disorientation errors persist. Why? Well, maybe we're disrupting the magnetic sense, causing pilots not to trust their instruments, for example.
So you're saying that we've been sort of living in this world ignorant of this magnetic sense that we have, and we have no idea what effect it might have had on the human race. I have to say, I've covered topics on the program before that there is it's probably a short enough time span on how they've played out. It'll be really interesting to follow your research and the research of others in your field over the next few years as they test this discovery. It's very exciting speaking with you. Joe Kirschwink, who's Professor of Geobiology at Caltech, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jonathan.
So I really meant what I said to Joe there. If it turns out that he's right, that the human being, given other senses aside, can actually detect the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field, that's huge. It's a huge finding. And it's only recent, 6 months ago, and in 2 years, we'll know if it's true. So it'll be very interesting to follow what happens in that field and see whether or not we can actually detect the magnetic field. The only reason I'm sort of a little bit cautious about it is because there have been a couple of people saying, nah, which I guess in almost every science paper, you always at the end, you have, we asked colleagues who may be envious of this finding whether or not they believed it. And they said, no way, this is BS, as Joe said. Right, time for your emails, texts, and tweets. We were speaking about weight loss and the GLP-1 injection, which claims to be able to help you not just reduce your weight loss, but also so far doesn't seem to have any negative effect. Lee in Kildare says, why always drugs to fix our ills? Just stop eating carbs and you'll lose weight. Food is better medicine than drugs. 5 years low carb and no problem keeping the 20 kg off that I lost. Because it's hard, Lee. It's really hard. I love food and I love sticking food in my mouth all the time. And just saying, well, just don't eat I find it really difficult not to eat what I want. And I'm currently on a diet because I was looking through some photographs of me 5 years ago and I'm like, ah, that was much better than this. This is not good. That was good. And so now I'm trying to, and I feel like my cells are screaming out for nourishment in the form of cream eggs and giant sandwiches. So it's been proven it's a very difficult thing to stop doing. And actually, if people could get an injection and fix it and it didn't have any ill effects, which we all know that just can't happen, can it, I'd be doing that every 6 weeks. On Skylink, we were talking about Elon Musk's plan to launch 1200 satellites into low Earth orbit to provide internet for the masses, while at the same time making our skies look like something from Space Invaders. Deck says, really, that was your first ever satellite? You need to get out more and spend more time outside at night. I know, theoretically, satellites aren't great for space, but they're cool to see. Yeah, I mean, I was telling the story last week of having seen the International Space Station. No, it was a satellite pass overhead. It was the first time I'd actually seen one with my naked eye. Deck, I tell you, man, with two kids living in Dublin City, it is very hard to find yourself in the middle of nowhere late at night looking up at the stars. And that's a sad truth, but it's not that often I get to do that. So, yes, it was my first time. Al says, I live in Darkest Wicklow and I've seen satellites glinting every 10 seconds or so. Really, that many? Another says, what are the radiation effects on humans from satellites? I would say probably negligible, because you're really only talking about reflecting of light from sun and a tiny amount from a tiny little thing. I would say very little, to be honest. Another, are satellites causing human illness, cancer, etc.? That's from Tom in Kildare. While I'm sure there haven't been many studies looking at the links, and I don't mean to be smart about it, I would imagine one of the things that stops people studying the effects of that are the probably lack of any physical mechanism that people can think of that would be a cause of that. There's just it's hard to imagine, knowing what we know about radio waves and radiation and satellites. I think most people would say there's no plausible mechanism for those things so far away causing cancer here on Earth. Matthias Malmer on Twitter says, I've not seen anything about the Starlink sats in a while. How visible are they now? There's occasional flaring. Actually, it started off this whole conversation on Twitter as a result of the program, which is nice to see that, you know, we're multimodal. And I'm always grateful to random texters for giving me and finally for this part of the program, because it just works as a nice segue into, and that's all we have time for this week. We had a random unattributed text from someone on the piece of Starlink and Elon Musk's mega constellation of satellites. He says, I presume it's a he, "Stargazing, are we all on some gigantic database in space? Are we being manipulated by some playing a kind of glass bead game? Do we matter, or are we just matter? Something for you to think about." And that's all we have time for this week. Thank you to Aidan McKelvey, who was producing. I'm Jonathan McRae. On sound was Jojo Cardozo, and Simon Keane was researching. We'll be back with more of this, where you found the podcast extra and gold during the week. We'll be back with more Future Proof on Saturday. In the meantime, stay curious.